ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Today, my guest is Dave Pearson. Dave runs a very exclusive club, but it's a club that no one wants to be a part of. Bite Club, yes, that's B-I-T-E Club, is for people who've survived attack by an apex predator. Sharks mainly, but there are also members who've escaped crocodiles, lions and bears. These are people who have experienced a primal human terror, and somehow they've made it out alive. But for many members of Bite Club, the initial elation of survival has been replaced by something darker. And that's where the fellowship of other survivors can make all the difference, as it has for Dave. His entry into Bite Club happened 13 years ago during an everyday after-work surf. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Sarah.
Can you tell me about that day at the beach? Why were you especially amped about having a surf that day?
I'd picked up a new surfboard the night before, so I was pretty keen to get out there. And I remember driving home from work. I worked 100 kilometres away from where I lived, so every afternoon was an hour's drive home. And I was ringing a couple of mates saying, I'm going for a surf sabo, anybody want a lift? And so I picked up my neighbour when I got home and off we went out to the beach. I was keen to surf anything. Doesn't bother me anyway, but I'm going out.
Were there other people in the water when you got there?
Yeah, when I got there, there was one of my young mates was out there on his own. And further up the beach, there was three or four bodyboarders. And I think there was another break out the back where there was a few more bodyboarders out there as well. So there was a few around, but only one guy where we were going.
And how long did it take for you to catch your first wave with that new surfboard?
I jumped off the rocks and paddled straight across onto a wave. And the other guys who I was paddling out with were not really back out there yet. I was the first one out, caught a wave, paddled back out, straight onto another wave and paddled back out again. Both of them were only short waves, but they were fun. And then I got a third wave. And as I was paddling for it, one of the other guys who was sitting on the outside of me, I told him to take it. And he goes, no, he said, you're in a better spot. So I took the wave and it was quite a long, good wave. And I had a big grin on my face because new surfboard, does it feel all right? It felt pretty good. And I was just on my way back out with a big grin on my face thinking this is going to be all right. And then everything sort of changed. So not even 10 minutes in the water and my afternoon took a very different turn.
What happened? What was the first thing? What do you remember?
I was in the rip paddling back out, as you do as a surfer, looking at the young guy who'd been out there when we turned up, watching the next set of waves coming through, watching to see who got one. And then the next thing, I just got hit by something. And I remember saying that night it was like being hit by a freight train, and it just, something hit me. Next thing I noticed, was under the water, there was bubbles everywhere, there was something big under there with me, but I couldn't make it out. What actually happened is the shark came from around about 1 o'clock, if you say the nose of the surfboard is 12 o'clock, and its bottom jaw got the surfboard on the way through, and its top jaw would have been wide open, and fortunately, I was looking off to the left-hand side, so 9 o'clock, and its snout hit me in the right temple, which kind of knocked me out as well. Unfortunately, it hurt my neck and back in the process, which I didn't realise, obviously, at the time. And because I was paddling, my left arm was going forward and ended up between the top jaw and the surfboard. So as we went down to the bottom, I was kind of stuck in its mouth. Fortunately, my thumb had gone into its mouth, but the rest of my hand had gone on the outside, so it didn't swallow my arm, luckily. And on the bottom, the top teeth just proceeded to tear the forearm muscle and straight off the bone, and the teeth decided it would take some tendons in my wrist and thumb and damage that as well. And then we sort of parted ways. We just separated down there, luckily, and I was kind of a bit stunned and swam back to the surface and climbed back on my surfboard and then looked down and realised what had just happened. It was it was then that I realised when my arm was tore open and there was blood going everywhere that I'd been bitten by a shark, and it was amazing. Like, I just, the realisation that it had happened was, it was just dumbfounded me. I was stunned.
How quickly did that all take, do you think?
I would say, you know, if I relive it, a half an hour, but in real life, probably 5-6 seconds maybe, probably not even that. It was quick.
Did you see the shark? Do you remember seeing it?
Yeah, afterwards I was sitting on my board and it took me, as I said, a little while to comprehend what was happening, and I heard Aaron, the young guy who was out there when we turned up, shouting out to me, and apparently he'd been shouting, "Dave, was that a shark? Was that a shark?" And the bit I heard, unfortunately, you know, it had a big F word in it as well. Then I sort of realised he was shouting to me, and I said, "Yeah, it's a shark," because I was looking at my arm and the blood squirting out, and I was thinking, that's not good, I've got to stop that bleeding. And in the process of looking at the red water around me and realising that sometimes they do get it right in the movies, I seen this big bull shark underneath me, and it was surprising to see its size, and also my reaction to it, because of being stunned and worried about bleeding, was that I didn't care about it. Just it didn't become part of my issue at that time. To me, it was trying to stop the bleeding and get out of the surf. But I did call back to Aaron and I said, "Look, it's still here, get out and I'll meet you on the beach." And I said, "I'll be all right." So I proceeded to kind of tuck my arm together and put all my weight on it and try to catch a wave one-handed, and a set come through and I thought, beauty, I'm out of here. But I wasn't in the right spot and the wave picked me up and I was too far in, so I got picked up and dumped straight into the sand again. Next thing, I'm rolling around the bottom again, not wanting to be there at all, and came back to the surface and got hit by another wave, and sets come in 3 to 4 waves and I got all four of them on the head. And at one stage I was at the bottom. You see stars for a little while and then you see nothing. And I was seeing stars and I'd known I'd run out of air and that I was about to, I guess, pass out, and realising that I was just about to die. And I went, wow, today's the day I die. And it was a tough realisation, I guess, that I actually now knew the moment of my life ending. So,
were you panicking, Dave, or was it sort of a different kind of acceptance? How do you describe it?
The acceptance that I was about to die was okay. I was cool with it. And I went, wow. You know, and it was, I realised that. I remember saying to myself, "You've had a pretty good life, so not a bad way to die surfing." And I went, wow. And then I thought, no, not today. And it was, you know, it was my family that brought it back. And I went, you can't die. And I felt the sand under my feet again and just pushed as hard as I could and got back onto the surface, started to tuck my arm back together again, climbed back on my surfboard. And it was then that I heard Aaron behind me, and he'd called out to one of my other mates, Sean, and he'd said, "Come on, we can't leave Dave on his own. He's going to get pounded." And them two guys got me out of the ocean.
Thank goodness. Did that shark reappear again, or did your friend see it?
No. Once I started moving, I never give the shark another thought. And obviously the guys were, I remember them saying afterwards, they were paddling over to me, thinking to themselves that they were actually getting out. And he said, "We just could not leave you. And even though we were trying to get a wave to get out, we were paddling in your direction." And, you know, that's the Aussie guy, you know. We help each other when things go wrong. And thankfully that's instilled in some of my mates.
Were you in pain by this point? Was that registering, or were you still in shock?
No pain at all. I'm looking down at my arm and there's like all the forearm muscles hanging off. There's blood going everywhere and I can see my bones, and I'm going, this isn't good. But no pain at all. Nothing for a good, I would say, 15 minutes. So it took us just more than 10 minutes to get out of the surf. And in that period, I'd lost 40% of my blood. So that was obviously the main struggle, which we didn't realise at the time, was that Dave might go into cardiac arrest and die. So fortunately, my mates, we all know first aid, and I'm so thankful that we do. And they took such good care of me until we could get the paramedics on side.
What could they do with you, Dave, when you've lost that amount of blood and you're just there at the beach, you don't have first aid kit with you or anything? What did they do?
As soon as we hit the beach, Sean, I remember Sean screaming out, just get his leg rope, and they pulled my leg rope off, wrapped it around my arm. I think they grabbed a stick that my dog came running down with in his mouth and used that to tighten it up to stop the bleeding on my arm. I remember Aaron saying, you know, hold his arm above his heart so, you know, try and keep the blood from going that direction. And also telling one of the young guys who, watching the commotion, had got out further up the beach and had come up, and he goes, look, we need to get a ambulance and a chopper here, tell them we've had a shark attack and we need to get them here as soon as possible. So, you know, all the things that we're trained to do in first aid in an emergency situation, I was just listening to guys doing that, thinking, wow, how awesome is this to be taken care of by guys who know what they're doing.
Did your partner know what had happened to you, Dave?
It's a bit of a story. I was supposed to be cooking dinner that afternoon.
The length you'll go to get out of it, hey?
That was what she said, yeah. So, yeah, so we got out. The guys sort of dragged me up the beach and threw me on a picnic table. I remember my neighbour also, my neighbour Scott, he became another tourniquet where he squeezed my arm so tight that he managed to stop any extra bleeding coming out. And I said to Sean, look, can you just pick up my phone? I'd actually dialed my partner Deb on the way to the beach just to say, look, I'm going for a quick surf before I get home. I said, just press redial and you'll get her. And yeah, he said, when she answered the phone, she said, hey, you. And Sean said, no, it's not Dave, it's Sean. And she goes, oh, what's he done now? Because I'm sort of a bit prone to hurt myself. I don't mind having a good hard crack at most things until I get hurt. And yeah, Sean said, he's been attacked by a shark. You need to get down here. And she goes, stop shitting me, Sean. What's he done? And he goes, no, Deb, he's been attacked and you need to get here. So she got down very quickly. I think she made a 20-minute trip in 10 minutes, thinking all the way that she better drive carefully. And in the process, she also rang some of my family members as well, my daughter. She rang my brother to let him know what had happened and that she was trying to head out to find out what was going on. And that was the first thing she said was the things you'll do to try and get out of cooking dinner. So, yeah, it was, and we tried to do that. Like, I tried to keep it lighthearted because I could see that the guys were struggling. There was, you know, I needed them to be obviously in a good condition to make sure I'm alive. And I was taking my vital signs and I realised my heart was up around 200 beats a minute, which meant obviously I'd lost some blood. My legs had gone numb and so had my hands and my arms were going numb, and that's the body shutting down what it doesn't need. Some will say my head's always numb anyway, so it really doesn't matter. But, yeah, so I was cracking jokes with the guys and apologising for ruining the surf the afternoon. But, yeah, we were just trying to keep it calm enough until help arrived.
So it sounds, Dave, like you didn't feel confident you were in the clear yet. It still feel like you might make it through this.
Yeah, and I guess that's obviously, you know, like I said, I've done first aid my whole life, and when you realise that the person you're looking after is not good, you've got to prepare yourself that, you know, maybe everything you do mightn't be enough. And I said to the guys, if I don't make it, you know, you've tried your best and don't worry about it. And I remember saying to my partner later on, because it was probably nearly an hour or so before ambulances even turned up at the beach, and I was laying there watching the sunset, and I said, well, it's not a bad night to die anyway. So like, once again, just trying to, you know, lighten the situation a bit. And the paramedic, when she got there, she said, oh, let's see what you're like. And she took my blood pressure and stuff, and her face went white. And I just told her when I met her afterwards not to play poker. She's not got a very good poker face. So, yeah, she said I was pretty sick when she got there. And they pumped fluids in me for the next hour or so before my heart would sort of get to some decent rhythm and a slow down enough to throw me in a helicopter and send me off to Newcastle.
What do you remember about that trip? Were you still taking things in?
Yeah, they pumped me full of morphine by then. The pain had become significant, let me say, by then. I guess your body's trying to figure out what's going on with all that damage, and then after a while I think it starts to figure it out. So they filled me up with morphine, which was a good and a bad thing. I'm not one for drugs, and it sort of made me a bit weird. But, I do remember my daughter turning up. She had been 45 minutes away, so she turned up before the helicopter even got there. And, you know, I said goodbye to everyone and thanked them once again as they loaded me into the ambulance and then into the helicopter. But a helicopter pilot sat there and he said, "Do you mind if we say a prayer?" And I'm not a religious man myself. But I said, if it's going to help me get to hospital, I said, I'm fine with anything. So,
pray away.
Yeah, so he was a lovely man, and I could only imagine some of the things that he's dealt with in his career and, you know, whatever people like that need to get him through the day, you know, more power to him. And, yeah, it was funny because when we landed at John Hunter Hospital, it was when the helicopter was banking, I had a set of headsets on, and the pilot said to me, "Davey, you still awake?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "See all them lights?" He said, "They're news crews." And there was, he said, "The whole strip's lit up with news crews. They want to talk to you." I said, "I'm really, I haven't got that much to say. I'm not very interesting. So that's going to be a quick conversation, isn't it?" And but they just wheeled me obviously straight through everyone. And Deb said, "Look, my hair's not even done." So yeah, they let Deb come down in the helicopter as well, because just in case I didn't make it. So I'm grateful for, you know, from the minute it happened right through till this very second of all the great things that's happened since. But, yeah, I got into the hospital. They started taking X-rays. They took an X-ray of my arm. They thought, well, because the bone had been damaged, the number one was is that that arm will probably come off tonight. And I went, "Wow," I said, "but I can still wiggle my fingers." And they go, "It's not that, it's the... the amount of damage plus to the bone as well, if it gets infected, it's not going to be good for you at all." And they said, "But we do have another surgeon coming in," and they allowed me to wait until in the morning. But
because what just, the alternative was they'd amputate that arm straight away.
Well, maybe that was what was going to happen. So, you know, given the choice of waiting for a few more hours, I'll obviously take the wait. And, yeah, just as I got that news, and the nurse who was sort of looking after me at the time said to me, "So you think you'll surf again?" Like, I'd just been told, you know, they're probably going to cut my arm off. And I went, "That's that." To me, that was a great thing because it made me think about something else. And I said, "Yeah." I said, "I'll surf again." I said, "My love of the ocean's far greater than my fear of sharks." I said, "So I'll be surfing again."
You could say that night.
Yeah. I said, "I'll figure it out. If I've even got one arm, I'll still figure it out somehow. There'll be some way to do it." So, yeah. The next morning, early, they prepped me, and the surgeon said that the trauma surgeon they had in there, he said, "Look, I've looked at everything," and he said, "Be prepared. We're not going to know what the result is." And he said, "But I will try and save your arm if I can." And he did. So I woke up out of surgery, and apparently sometimes you wake up out of surgery. I was confused, obviously, but I was cranky, and I apparently give the nurses a bit of a hard time for a few minutes until it sort of dawned on me what was going on. And I said, "What the hell am I doing here?" And the nurse said, "You've been attacked by a shark." And I used a bit of choice language and I said, "No, I haven't." And she goes, "Yes, you have. Look at your arm." And so I looked at my arm, I lifted my arm up, and the pain was unbelievable when I went to move my arm. And then it dawned on me that I still actually had an arm. So, yeah, it was like straight away I was elated that, yes, something had happened and my arm was still there.
When you were recovering from your surgery, you found out that there was another shark attack survivor also in the hospital. What was her story?
Yeah, I'd actually been at Newcastle the day that happened, and I was working not far from Nelson's Bay and heard the helicopter fly over. You know, it stands out that it's, you know, red and yellow, and it's obviously a rescue helicopter that we see in our area a lot from car accidents. And I was listening to the radio, and they just announced on the radio that there'd been a shark attack at Jimmy's Beach, and the girl was on her way to hospital in, you know, grave condition. So I guess as a surfer, you don't think about shark attacks until it happens to you. But listening to that one on the radio and watching the helicopter sort of made me realise, you know, that there'd obviously been a shark attack. And I went, "Wow, I hope she's all right." And not knowing that the next week I'll be in the same hospital, just, you know, a floor underneath her. Suffering a similar fate. So, yeah, we met up. As soon as I was in there, I just, like, out of surgery and started to recover, I sent a message upstairs and said, "Look, I'd love to have a chat." And the day they were kicking me out of hospital. She was still up in intensive care, so we sat down and had a chat. And it was quite enlightening. We both had injuries to our left arm. We both had had injuries to the right side of our head. I have to say my injuries are nothing compared to hers. So we just talked about our attacks to each other and how familiar her attack was to mine and how mine was to her. And I took something away from that straight away. It was like, wow, this is, you know, it's a tough meeting, and it always is, but there's a connection there straight away. And I often say, like, meeting other shark attack survivors are like family that you've never met before, because you've got that connection. You don't have to worry about that awkward, you know, getting to know someone. You can talk about one of their worst experiences straight up, and you go through the, I guess, the learning phase of each other's life very quickly. And so you become very comfortable with each other very quickly after you have that conversation. And, you know, her mum and dad were in there with her as well at the same time, so I get to say hello to the family, because, you know, Bike Club, we treat it like a family, so any family members welcome in our group and welcome at any event we do, because it's family members that get us through the worst of our tough lives sometimes. And, I just love meeting families as well, because, you know, they're often sitting there in trauma with nothing to say about it, but you know they're suffering through it as well. So it's nice to give them recognition, but plus to also offer them some support. And Deb does that a lot, and it's I'm so appreciative of the work that she does.
As you were flying in, you say that the ambulance pilot said, you know, look at all these lights, there's all this media waiting to talk to you. How aggressive were journalists in trying to get access to you and the story in the days after this attack?
Deb couldn't get in and out of the hospital without being questioned. You know, we had her daughter was there as well. My daughter and her boyfriend were there. My brother and sister were also there, and mum and dad even come down after a day or so as well. So everybody that they started recognising as my family, they were hassling. So I said to the hospital had a media section, and I said, look, can you just find out what they want, and I'll give an interview to somebody, and they can leave the hospital alone and let you get on with your job. So I did one interview, and, yeah, just I said, thank you, can we please have our privacy now, and let's get on with what I need to do, and that's get fixed up.
What was it like reading about your own story in the media like that? It's not an experience most of us have in our lives.
It's like it's a bit of a buzz. I won't say it's not. Like everyone loves reading about themselves. So it was interesting. Some of the stories were I don't know whether will I say the word made up, but I think not getting the full facts, but in a hurry to go to print. They obviously got some things wrong. At one stage, I'd lost an arm and a leg. And when I started looking at some of the news stories and reading the stories about me, and that's when I found that lovely section at the bottom, which allows everybody to comment on a news story and pass their opinion and judgment as much as they want. Mm. And that's when I started reading stuff about me that I just knew wasn't true, like the TV cameras all had me coming into the hospital at 9:30 at night. So I was attacked at 5:30. So it was 4 hours by the time I got to the hospital. So the comments are, you know, what does this guy expect surfing at night? No wonder he got bit. It's his own fault. You know, all these sort of things. No, I'm just answering it going, hey, this is the guy. And no, I wasn't surfing in the dark. It was only 5:30 when I was attacked. Plenty of daylight left, at least 2 hours of daylight left. It just happened. I'm fine with it. You know, I accept responsibility. I was in the ocean. I got bit. That's okay. The answers were coming back. No, you don't. You blame the sharks. You want to kill them all. And it's just these stupid comments. And the more I tried to, I guess, diffuse the situation, the worse it became. Oh. And I just went, wow, these people. And that was my last comment, I think, was nobody here knows me. You don't know me. You're making judgment of me from your own opinion, which is fine. But I don't need this in my life, so F you lot. And I slammed my computer down. I was sitting there and I'm thinking, you know, I had tears running down my face. I go, I didn't deserve any of that, and I got it. But, it was quite, I guess, surreal to read about myself and how people can quickly form an opinion. I had no opinion on sharks, and I still don't. we have people within our group with all sorts of opinions as well. We would have people in our group who would like to see all sharks culled, and then we've got people in our group who want to go out and hug all the sharks. So I have to be neutral because I need to communicate effectively with everybody in that group, and I need to understand where it comes from. And then if, you know, with education within everyone else in the group, we form, I guess, our own opinions again, and we try and get the truth out there to our own members to understand where our opinions are coming from.
Did you grow up spending a lot of time in the ocean, Dave?
I grew up in the western suburbs of Sydney, so beach for us was an hour and a half away, so that was a Sunday family trip. So we'd pack everybody in the car, go down the beach really early in the morning. We'd, you know, from the western suburbs, we would head down to the Royal National Park. We'd usually get there before anybody else was, 6 o'clock in the morning. Dad would cook us bacon and eggs on a barbecue down the beach, and we'd spend the whole day playing in the waves, and that's where, I guess, my love of surfing started.
So this was when you, your family were living in Western Sydney, but that's not where you started life, Dave. Where were you born?
I was born in the UK in a little fishing village called Hartlepool in the northeast. It was all about fishing. Most of the industry in town was fishing the North Sea, which can be quite treacherous. We would see the beach every so often. Obviously, in England, it's a lot colder than
it
is here in Australia.
It's not as inviting as it is at the Royal National Park, that's for sure.
No, certainly not as inviting. But needless to say, I remember swimming when I was, you know, 4 or 5 year old in the ocean as well. So,
you also had a stint in hospital as a little kid. What had happened?
Yeah, as I said, unfortunately, if there's somebody going to get hurt, it's going to be me. And, yeah, one in particular, I was in preschool. A young girl that I was in class with scratched me in the eye, and back in the good old 60s, we used to use stuff called lead-based paint, even in schools, and my eyes got infected. And off to hospital I went, and they give me penicillin, to which I had an allergic reaction and went blind. So
Completely?
Completely blind, yeah. And it was due to the infection. It's something behind the eyes got infected and just basically cut off the communication between my eyes and my brain. And, yeah, so I do remember, I have this lovely memory whenever I go past somewhere that's mown grass that's been really long and it's sort of wet. So you get that little sour smell from, you know, freshly cut grass, and it brings me laying in that hospital bed not being able to see anything straight to my mind. It's a nice experience.
Something you could smell from your hospital bed, was it?
Yeah. Apparently when I did get my eyesight back and I went back to that hospital, I remember there was a big field right beside it, so they would run a tractor around and mow it when it got too long.
How long were you without your sight for?
A couple of months, I think, in total. Obviously, no use just keep me in hospital, so they sent me home with a pair of sunglasses on and, you know, with some treatment for mum to do every morning. I would wake up and my eyes would be closed with scabs over the top of both my eyes, and she would soak them off in some warm antiseptic water, and yeah, off I'd go for the day, sitting around not doing much. And I remember not being that stressed about it, other than not being able to do anything. I was only 5 year old, so kids get through things a lot easier than adults do, and that's another thing I've learned, you know, since my shark attack. The kids are so resilient and they can get over things really well.
Did that experience leave you more physically cautious than you'd been before? Like, did it change the kind of kid you were in terms of being in the outdoors or anything?
No, not at all. I guess, you know, growing up in the western suburbs of Sydney when we came to Australia, my dad would travel for work. He was a telecommunications engineer, so he spent some of his time over in WA in the mines putting in telephone exchanges and things like that. Mum was working in a children's home, so we were, I guess, not left to our own devices, but we were them kids who, you know, would look after each other when we got home from school. We'd come home, do our homework, get changed and go out and play football all afternoon until it got too dark. That was my life as a kid. So it was either push bike riding or football or skateboarding. Skateboarding became my major passion once I discovered surfing, because if I wasn't in the ocean, at least I could be on a skateboard.
And there's plenty of opportunities for accidents there too, Dave.
Definitely. Yeah, I got the scars to prove it.
What sort of work did your mum do when you were living in Western Sydney?
So mum worked in an orphan's home. It was in Baulkham Hills, was the suburb, and it's nice because Mum and Dad are still with us, and we go out to dinner at least once or twice a week, and we always talk about the old times. And I remember the day we got to Australia, Dad walked from, we were at the Malabar in the Nissen huts that they put the immigrants in, and Dad walked from there to Alexandria. We arrived at 8 o'clock in the morning, and Dad had a job by 1 o'clock. And I do remember Mum walking from Parramatta to Baulkham Hills. It's in the middle of summer. It's like, you know, 10-kilometre walk just so she could get a job. She was in a children's home looking after, you know, orphan children. And it was great because back then when we were kids, it was school holidays. You know, Mum and Dad could take kids to work. So I quite often went to the children's home and hung out with the kids, did the laundry with Mum, cleaned, you know, did anything to keep myself busy while I was there. But I guess it's a different thing when you're meeting kids and you've got your mum with you and they don't have any mum and they don't have any dad. So the conversations are, even for a kid, they're a lot different. And then you realise how lucky you are because you do have a mum and a dad and ones that love you and look after you. So I guess that's why, you know, Mum and Dad mean so much to me.
It's such a big thing to move your family from one side of the world to the other. Do you think your parents were happy with the decision that they made, that risk they took?
Yeah, they are. It's been a big step and one that, you know, I appreciate so much. We've had a great life here in Australia and so did Mum and Dad. You know, we've had a great life and a great family life. Because we've got no relatives here, we became, you know, a very tight family unit looking after each other all the time. But on many occasions, now that we've got our own children and we've got our own grandkids and, you know, Dad said the other night, he said, "How did I become so lucky to end up with this crew?"
So there you were growing up in Western Sydney, skating and surfing and went on to build your own life, Dave, and had kids of your own. And the ocean continued to play this really important part in your life all the way up until you find yourself face to face with that shark in 2011. Take me back to the emotion of the days after that. Was it pure elation that you felt?
Yeah, it's like every day is just a new high. Number one, obviously, surviving. Yeah, I was pretty happy about that. Second day after I come out of surgery, I've still got my arm. I was really happy about that. And, you know, a week later when the surgeon looked at my arm for the final time and he told me how he believes he'd done a really good job getting it all together, it even made me happier again. And then obviously to go home, it was great. So it was every day was better than the one before until it wasn't.
Until it wasn't. What was that change? When and how? Do you remember that?
I can specifically tell you the exact day that it all fell apart. And it was, you know, I got out of the hospital on the following Tuesday. I was attacked on a Wednesday. They discharged me on the following Tuesday. And it would have been the Thursday. I'd woke up in the morning. I had a migraine. And my arm was not happy at all. The pain was intense. And then in the early days, the pain, I mean, the early days, the first 3 years, it was tough to deal with the pain on a daily basis. And I got up and I took some Panadine Forte because I didn't want to take the endones that I'd been given. And that didn't work. And so I took a couple of endones and that didn't work. And my partner, Deb, before she left for work, made me a couple of slices of toast and a cup of tea. And I was sitting at the kitchen table and my daughter went off to school and Deb went off to work. And I was sitting there finishing my breakfast and I went to get off the chair and the whole room was spinning and I'd done too many drugs and I was a mess. And I crawled from the kitchen to the lounge room chair. I was half asleep, half awake and having the strangest dreams. Not that I would call nightmares, but just strange dreams. And it was very uncomfortable. And then when I woke up again, I was in all sorts of pain again. And it wasn't long after that that I woke up screaming in the middle of the day. I think Deb was out the front when I went, had a snooze in the chair. My dog was laying beside me and somebody did something outside and the dog barked. I woke up screaming and it was when Deb came in and said, "You know you're doing that a lot." So that was when I knew that things weren't going all right. I was still pretty happy. I was planning to start work soon, but yeah, that was the first sign that things weren't right. And it was being at home during the day on my own, dealing with the pain, while everyone else was out, obviously, doing what they needed to do, school, work, things like that, that it became a tough ask to try and get on with my life. Yeah, and I guess especially with the episode of starting to get the funny dreams and the screaming in the night, and I think the screaming was, I do remember it later on, the screaming was me shouting out, "Don't jump." And it was, the dream was I was standing on the rock that I jumped off the afternoon that I was attacked. And I was watching myself from the car park, just about to jump in with the surfboard, and I would scream, "Don't jump." Yeah, that's where that one came from.
You'd had that connection in the hospital with that other shark attack survivor. How did you get the idea to reach out to other survivors?
There was an attack not long after mine down on the central coast of New South Wales. And so I went, you know what, I'm going to ring this guy and let him know that here's some things that you can expect to go on in your head afterwards. So don't be scared of it. And it's much better when things are not a surprise to you. So I reached out to the hospital, passed my message on. Obviously, if you're ringing a hospital cold and you're not a relative of someone, you got Buckley's chance of getting through. So I just started leaving my phone number and letting them know that I too had been attacked by a shark, and, you know, I'm here to talk to if you want to go through my experience and I can tell you what's going on in my head. Obviously, anybody who's been attacked prior to me is further ahead in their journey than I am, so I'm keen to listen to them. So hopefully someone else would be keen to listen to me. And that's basically how it started. And I would reach out to any hospital, any news story I did, I would say, can you please put me in touch with anyone else you're speaking with? I would like to talk with them. I was fortunate that I had a meeting with the Department of Prime Industries, and they came and identified the species of shark and the size, and it was part of a documentary that they were doing due to bull shark attacks in Sydney Harbour. So my attack being by a bull shark was on their radar, and they came and had a chat with me. So straight away I formed a relationship with the head scientist from the Department of Primary Industries. And I guess originally it was a love-hate relationship. They're all excited about catching and tagging sharks and finding out what they're doing. And one of their tagged sharks was off Crowdy the day I was attacked. And so I had that originally was like, wow, you know, here's a shark that's being caught that possibly could have been the one that bit me. If they'd took it out of the equation back then, would I still be all right? So, you know, straight away you start thinking things like that. And it was, you know, obviously I'm not happy if you've caught the thing and then let it go and it bit me. But honestly, that doesn't bother me anymore, that sort of thing. And we meet quite regular, and he's a lovely guy.
So through these connections and phone calls, you started to meet other survivors of attacks. How did Bite Club expand to survivors of other kinds of animal attacks, not just sharks?
The first one we got was a young lady in WA who'd been attacked by a crocodile. And yeah, she got in touch and said, look, you know, I've got no one who's been able to talk to. Can I join up with you guys? And I just went, of course you can. And then from then, you know, later on we had a girl who'd been attacked by a lion, same situation. She said, you're the only animal attack support group I can find anywhere in the world. And I said, well, come on board. And, yeah, we've had dingo attacks, crocodiles, alligators, hippopotamus, bears, lions, wolves. So just about anything that's going to attack someone, I think we've got in our group now.
How would you keep in touch with individual members in the early days when there weren't so many people? What kind of responsibilities were on your shoulders?
In the early days, I would call everybody once a week, basically. I would, working in Newcastle, so it was a two-hour drive home of a Friday when I finished work for the week, I would just be calling people the whole way. And sometimes I'd get to six or seven people. Some afternoons it was one person for a two-hour conversation. So it was good. Like, it was a nice way to end my week, is to see how everyone else was doing. And it was therapeutic in a way for me and for others. And it was then that I discovered what we were doing was far greater than just a bunch of people talking to each other. And I'll say that because one Friday afternoon on the way home, I rang a guy in WA And he told me he was going to commit suicide the day before. And it was the fact that he knew I was going to call him that he couldn't do it. He said he didn't want to let me down because he wanted to have a chat. So that was a tough realisation. I remember getting home and Deb would know whether I'd had a good week away or not because it was how long the hug lasts when I get home. So, she said, tough one. And I said, yeah, tough one. I said, I don't think I was ready for this, to actually understand that somebody's attack was affecting them to such a state that they wanted to pass their own life on after surviving such a horrible thing. It was a tough one to deal with.
Where do you get your support, Dave? I'm hearing how much support you give to other people. Who are you leaning on?
Lots of other people in the group will call me all the time. It's so nice. Like we all look after each other. I'm also, like I said before, I've got a relationship with the Department of Prime Industry where over the years Bike Club has become their community liaison when it comes to a tough attack, and we will go out and speak to the community about what they can expect and, you know, how tough a shark attack can be on not just individuals but communities. And there's some wonderful people within the Department of Prime Industry. I get a lot of support from some wonderful people there. But, yeah, most of my support is from my own family. My son is just, he's so funny because he's so blasé about lots of things. So I'll be going away for a day to do something and he goes, oh, it's more shark shit, is it, Dad? And I go, yeah, it's just, so he's like that. But he knows that when I come home, I'm going to be doing it a bit tough and he'll go, come on, Dad, let's go for a ride on the motorbikes or, you know, let's do something. And my daughter's absolutely beautiful. She's that one special person in the world that everybody needs to have in their life, and she keeps me and my son calm. And my partner, Deb, she's been through hell with me over the years. And, you know, the ocean's where I've always took my problems. Like, you know, there was a day, you know, many years ago, my first daughter died, and I went surfing. And it wasn't just to get away from it. It was just to try and clear my head. And I actually paddled out and I sat in the ocean for about an hour and a half and did nothing and just sat there. So I can't seem to do that as much anymore, because when I sit there in the ocean on my own, I think about other things and it's not, you know, it's not how I want it to be. So, yeah, the ocean just has always been my place of healing, and when that also becomes, unfortunately, a source of my distress, then it can be a bit tough as well. You know, when I first started having post-traumatic stress really bad, what used to happen for some reason is, you know, my first daughter would come into my mind, and it was strange. It was very comforting to know that she was there in my mind. And unfortunately, it was also a really bad day at the same time. So I tried to turn that around, and I would know when I woke up in the morning if I was going to have a bad day. And then I would say, but I'll get to think about Tia today, so it's going to be a good day. Mm-hmm. And I worked it out like that, and I just went, all right, it's going to be tough, but try and take the positive out of it. And I try to turn everything into some sort of positive. And like I said, sometimes I have some really tough conversations and I know it's going to get me, but the positive is I know someone else is also going to be a little bit comforted by it and they're going to be having a little bit better day tomorrow than I'm having. So good on it.
I know that your daughter passed away when she was just still a little baby. Were there people that you could reach out to then? Like, I'm just thinking as you're describing how you've, you know, created this community of people who can share this really difficult thing that no one would understand unless they'd been through it. Was there a community there for you when that happened?
Sort of. But as a 20-odd-year-old male who was paying the mortgage and working, it was my job to make sure I got back to work and paid the bills. And so I kind of put that in a basket for a while. My wife at the time, we had a ladies' group around that, unfortunately, a number of women who'd lost children, and they would get together and talk about it, and hopefully it would help. For me, we still had I had my young son at the time. He was only a couple of years old, so, you know, busy at work, busy at home. I'll deal with that later on, as most of us do with trauma in our lives. We just put it in a basket and I'll get to that some other time in my life. And it was quite a while later when, you know, a shark tipped over that basket for me and said, start dealing with this, Dave. And, I have to.
How long did it take you to get back in the water, back in the surf after that attack in 2011?
I come out of hospital on the Tuesday. Saturday morning I was down the beach in the water, and it was the scariest experience of my life. It was every little bit of seaweed in the water was a shark. It was so weird. And I got back out of the water and not happy with the situation at all. And I walked back in and I went, you've done this like millions of times in your life. It's only the ocean. It's fine. And the water was clear. There was no issues. And next thing, Deb runs past with a surfboard under her arm, paddles past me. She's going out the back for a surf on her own. And you go, she's just showing me that it's all right. And so I stood there and I got as deep as I possibly could. I think it was up to my chest because I had to hold my cast above the water. And, that was my first experience back. And every time I got out of the surf, someone would pull up on the beach and want to know about what was going on. And it was then that I realised that everybody in the local community was affected by what had happened to me. Even if they weren't there, it was still affecting them.
What about other people in Bike Club? Because not everyone had your keenness or willingness to take that step and get back in the water. How has that been something you've helped people confront?
It's great if you can get back in the water with their first go. A lot of people I've been fortunate to, you know, as soon as I meet them, I say, look, if you want some support when you go back in the ocean, give me a buzz and I'll turn up and we'll go do it together. And I've done that with a number of people and it's so special. Number one, for a surfer to actually be able to go back in the ocean and have a surf is great, because if you've been out for any length of time for whatever injury you've got, it gets frustrating and you miss that mental health treatment that you get from in the ocean. So to be part of someone's return to the ocean is great. And we've had many events where, you know, you paddle out with someone, you take them out for their first surf, and then you have a barbie on the beach and a cup of coffee or a couple of beers and just celebrate that life's got some normality back in it again. And they're pretty special. We've done a few events where we brought a young guy down from far north Queensland who'd lost his leg. We brought a guy up from South Australia who'd also lost his leg a couple of years prior. And there was about, I think, 20 odd of us turned up, and we all went out in the ocean together to take him for his first trip back in the water. And we just sat in the ocean and all in a circle and had a conversation about how the ocean means so much to us and that's why we're here supporting each other. And to see the change in his life, not only from that but from another few great things that happened within the group, helping him out with other things and just giving him the drive to move on and move forward with his life. And you just get so much from it and you go, wow, we had a tiny bit to play in this guy's success going forward, and now he's got a life that means something to him and he's got his family and they're all happier. And, yeah, just to be part of that is great. And, if somebody says, I want to go for a surf, and I'll say, yep, I'm in on it.
It's 13 years since you survived that attack. How did you spend your very first anniversary?
My plan was to turn up at the same time as my attack and paddle out the same spot and hopefully have a good surf. And when I got to the beach, you know, all my mates who were there the evening that I was attacked, plus all my other surfing mates were there as well. And they were all out in the ocean when I got there. And my son was home, my daughter was there. So we're all out in the surf. I paddled back out. And before I even got a wave, there was this big disturbance on the water and a bull shark come to the surface. I could see its head as it came up and then it just whipped its tail.
What? Bull shark in the water on that day?
On that day at the same time. And it was just like, wow, this is a sign here. You know, it's either a good sign or a bad sign. And one of the guys looked at me as if to say, is Dave going to freak out here? And I just went, not today. It's not ruining my day today. And, it shot through, went, you know, we could see it after that heading out a bit. So I proceeded to have a nice surf in the afternoon. A little bit uneasy, but it was good. And then we We got out, you know, everyone was cooking meat on the barbie and having a few beers and just talking about what a great afternoon it was. And my partner Deb said, "Dave, check that out." And as we were looking at the sunset in the clouds, there was a cloud, and below the high layer of cloud was a shark shape underneath. And everybody just looked at it and went quiet, and it was like, wow, this is a moment here. And it was really funny because, as I said, the night I was attacked, I laid there and watched the sunset, and it was beautiful. And I said, a beautiful night to die. And here we were having a very similar situation, so 1 year on. But the beauty of the celebration afterwards is everybody else starts telling you what was happening to them on that day and what they heard and how they felt. And that, to me, that's the most healing part of it, is everybody else being able to let go of their situation as well.
Dave, what an honour to speak with you on Conversations. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, Sarah. If there's anybody out there suffering, please don't suffer alone. Find someone you can talk to, or I'm always up for a chat.
I spoke with Dave Pearson in 2025. This episode of Conversations was produced by Alice Moldovan and recorded on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. The executive producer was Carmel Rooney. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. You're listening to Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. Find out more about the Conversations podcast. Just head to abc.net.au/conversations.